Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight we're going to talk about a couple of things that are embarrassing to the United States. One of them is the fact that with the stroke of a pen, the head of the Communist Party of North America, Osama bin Laden, has opened the doors to Cuba and overridden the Cuban blockade. And, of course, the liberals are all dancing in the streets with their clothes off, as usual. And they're thrilled. But I'll tell you who's not thrilled. And that's the Cuban-Americans who have gotten a shaft for the third time in my lifetime. And I'm just going to give you the highlights of it. There's an article by a guy named Dan Wheel, and his title of his article is Cuban Americans Angry Over Obama Easing Policy. By the way, this has been in the works before Obama. Ted Kennedy tried to do it when they lifted Elian Gonzalez. Imagine Ted Kennedy. Man, there was a guy, he could be bought and sold six times over, but he's in a good place tonight. He's in boiler number three, down there with a few of the other boys. I wonder what it's like to be under Hitler. At the level. Cuban Americans aren't too happy about the Obama administration, according to Dan Wheel. The decision last week to allow more U.S. travel to Cuba. He's just letting communists go right now at this time. And we'll all go because we want the cheap prices, and where prostitution is only 25 cents for 3 hours. Yeah, we'll all be going. All the pervs will be going first. They'll be there to spend the Yankee dollar singing rum and Coca-Cola. Yeah. And they're going to make it easier. Obama's making it easier for schools, churches, and cultural groups. Yeah, that's the pedophile association to visit the island. A senior White House official told the Miami Herald the much-expected move to expand cultural, religious. All of a sudden, Obama's got religion. Yeah. And whichever one is fashionable this week. I wait till you see him come to the podium in a, wearing a sari, you know, to match his look, the sari look. Yeah. He's going to come dressed as a Buddhist priest next time. He'll shave his head. Yeah, like the guy that the crazy in Arizona. You know, you picture your favorite politician with a shaved head, and I guarantee you they all match that profile. Yeah, you shave Hillary Clinton's head, and you'll see that guy's twin. Anyway, so they're going to expand cultural, religious, and educational travel. Watch that educational hook. They're going to use that in so many ways against you, you're not going to believe it. They wanted to do a benefit for American war heroes, and they lumped them in with students. They said, "Yes, we'll give the benefit to veterans and students." Why is a student entitled to the same benefits as a veteran? What did a student ever do? Huh? But anyway, except live off his parents. Yeah, I made it the hard way. Yeah, Dad had to work 5 more years. Yeah. I don't want to hear it. Don't tell me. Don't tell me how you sacrificed. You don't know the meaning of sacrifice. I once had a business, and my employees asked me how I would describe a company man, and I said a company man is a guy on the worst business day of the week with an $11 deposit. Takes 6 bullets in the chest trying to save the money for his boss. And they all quit right after. Okay, so, and this is great. This is great. I gotta read you this last line. Yeah, a senior White House official told the Miami Herald that this is the administration's continuing effort to support the Cuban people's desire to freely determine their own future. And tomorrow we crush Honduras for the party. Yeah, man, we lost our country and we're never getting it back. It's gone. Kiss it goodbye. Right now, the only guys that are left are the ones that are picking up the loose change and closing out their 401ks and booking world tours. Well, like, so they can debate what country they're going to seek asylum in. So I replied, I said, Cuban Americans aren't too happy. What are you, Arizona crazy? Poor Arizona. There's a state that was minding its own business, and it's been beat up more than a battered housewife. Why would they be? They have been betrayed more times than Jesus. First by the Democrats at the Bay of Kennedy's, where they were sold out to Castro. Then JFK told the survivors one day their flag would fly over Havana. Instead, it's in a museum, along with other false Democrat promises. Fast forward to the night of the Democrat long knives, where a SWAT team with instructions to take Elian Gonzalez, even if he is in church, and the capture code. You know what the capture code was when they snatched the kid? When they stomped the grandmothers that were praying, they classified the grandmothers as terrorists. Yeah, I'm going to tell you something. That's going to happen in your house one day when they find out that you cling to conservative culture. The capture code was bingo, bingo, bingo. Now, where is bingo played? It's played in a church. You're going to tell me that they thought they were going to a church because Ilian's relatives said they were going to take him to a church and try and get sanctuary. So they were prepared. They probably rehearsed in the church. They probably attacked the same bingo. That was the Clinton gift to Fidel. And Chuck Schumer held the kid's feet off the ground, claiming he never touched American soil. There's a guy who's the personification of evil, Chuck Schumer. And who's sitting in his lap tonight? A Republican. They're both no good. If you don't go Tea Party, you're going to have, the party is going to be over for you and your family. You better go Tea Party. And when the last of those World War II vets dies, they're going to rewrite history, and you're never going to recognize your country. To prove that Democrats and Republicans are the same. Oh, by the way, somebody sent me an email, and it said, if you want to cut welfare, you want to cut welfare down to next to nothing, have all the application forms in English. To prove that Democrats and Republicans. Oh, wait a minute. Let me see what I said. Let me go back. Oh, they chimed. Yeah, Chuck Schumer. I say he held the kids' feet off the ground. You know when this took place? It took place on Easter week when nobody would be around and all the snakes could say, well, I was busy praying. And John Kerry was putting boiler room ashes on his forehead. Yeah, him and Kennedy, that's what they used to do. They weren't allowed in the church, so they had to go down to the boiler room and they used to put ashes on their forehead and come up for a press release. Yeah, okay, so Chuck Schumer held the kids' feet off the ground, claiming he never touched American soil. Of course, there's a rule, you know, that if somebody with compassion for Cubans made, and it says if a Cuban can escape Cuba and can swim the shark Decathlon in a tire tube that's got bites on it, and his feet touch American soil, he is entitled to asylum. So the Democrats are all down at the beach and they're holding the kids' feet off the ground. And then they chimed in. Schumer said this in a statement. Ilion was too young to know freedom. Like a fetus in a Democrat pro-choice womb. Let me tell you, I got parakeets that know freedom. Yeah, unbelievable. Too young to know freedom. There's an Irish song. It was early, early in the spring. The birds did whistle and sweetly sing. And the song they sang from tree to tree was, please God, old Ireland free. Yeah. Too young to know freedom. Well, this is coming from the people that call fetus tissue. A child is tissue. He's not an American. He's not a citizen. He's not a human being. How do you know he's a he? Because it shows up on the sonogram. Yeah. Kill him anyway. Yeah. They chimed, Ilion was too young to know freedom, like a fetus in a Democrat pro-choice womb. To prove that Democrats and Republicans are the same, Jeb Bush swallowed his tongue. Don't even think about running, Jeb. We're all ambushed out. Help your brother build the Clinton Library. Don't forget to build a memorial to Donald Rumsfeld, the second Ilion Gonzalez, betrayed as a Christmas present to Obama. Not even honorable mention in George's best edited cellar. Sorry, George. I looked for Rumsfeld in that book, and I would not read any more. Whoever wrote it, they did a wonderful job, and we're all snowed. We've all been blizzarded. The night that Ilion was snatched and drugged, they accused, with the help of the communist news network CNN, they accused grandmothers holding candles and saying the rosary of terrorism. Not a politician or a judge in sight. They spit in God's face on Easter Saturday to mock a Christ crucified the night before by government order. Kendall Coffey was on the fax machine, waiting for the fax to come through. What a rehearsed betrayal. The payoff was supposed to be a boat full of Kennedys sailing into Havana. They had booked a love boat to go to Cuba. They thought this was it. They had to cancel because the people got too mad. It wouldn't have looked good. It would have been too obvious they were sticking it to America once again. Even as Geraldo Rivera said, a kidnapped boy whose mother died bringing him to freedom belonged with his communist father, who happened to be disembarking from a plane with Soviet mind-altering drugs, kitty size. The communists in the House and the Senate, with the help of the communist media, managed to turn Puerto Ricans and Haitians against the Cuban community. I remember, I think it was the illustrious bagman of the Clinton administration, Jesse Philip Jackson saying if he was Haitian, he wouldn't have had a chance. Yeah, that's the way to do it. Divide and conquer, Jesse. Play that race card, all 52 of them. Now they do it again for a third time. Look who Obama bin Laden, knee marks, is sending to Cuba. Religious, that will include the Communist Council of Marxist churches, and students who did not get enough brainwashing in Communist Cucumber Condom School. They are now going to get their Red Star degree in Che Guevara University, only to come back as part of the Obama military, which he promised to make bigger than the U.S. military. American dollars will float to Havana, and that will prevent a starving Cubans from eating still life paintings. My only question is, how much is Fidel worth? And drugs is more profitable than sugarcane that students cut for nothing. Is he 500 million ahead of the Clintons? When does Obama score? After he's out, or when he is in forever? You lost your country, America, and you're never getting it back. Look, the Repuppies are sitting in Democrat laps. More to you, anybody? Hang in there. We'll give you a tune. And I think if the tune I uploaded a few minutes ago is up there, we will all enjoy a Latin American tune, God willing. Oh, I'm going to have to come out and go back in. Okay, go back in, Tom. And look for that tune. Here it is. Here it is. The tune I'm dedicating to all the Cuban Americans who got shafted. They've gotten three times, like Christ fell three times. They've been shafted at least three times. And I hope one day you get justice. I hope one day everybody who betrayed you gets karma back. Here's Cuban Fantasy. Okay, I'm back, and we're doing, and I'm doing Chapter 7 tonight of Red Cocaine. I just want to flip back to Chapter 6 and the last paragraph, and I just want you to know that the strategy of the Soviets has not changed, okay? Like many people will say, the leopard never changes its spots. Worldwide communism is a master plan, and it's to seek the domination of the world. And they are very successful, and they never give up. Like Jimmy from Brooklyn says, when they win, and when they lose, they win. Okay? He says that we're playing checkers, and they're playing chess. And he also believes that the fall of the Berlin Wall just caused the Soviets to change their strategy. And it look, and when they... The Chinese and the Soviets play good communist, bad communist, and they're all playing. They have one major goal: that's to destroy the West, and we are the West. In case you didn't know it, and one day you will hear the word crusader spoken with reverence, because I got a feeling the crusades are coming back too. So the last page of chapter six is talking about how. The communists in Vietnam infected the U.S. military with heroin. And in 1971, prior to 1970 and 71, there had been two deaths per month due to drug overdose. And suddenly, it jumped to 60 a month, and the U.S. Air Force lost more people to drugs than to combat. And, you know, that's the years 1970 and 71, and I know people who died of heroin overdoses right here in New York. In Vietnam, according to Chapter 6, the GIs were paying nothing for heroin or a dollar, and in New York they were paying $250. Unbelievable. So here's Chapter 7, Moscow intensifies drug warfare in the late 60s. Nothing has changed. The distribution routes that were founded back then are still the same, okay? Some of the players have changed, but the people on top are still the same. Those who were getting the most money are still getting the most money. The Vietnam War provided an ideal opportunity for the extension of Operation Druzhba Narodov, the alienation of youth, which was proliferating in the U.S., and the preoccupation of the U.S. government and citizenry with the Vietnam War presented distraction and cover, which enabled the Soviet offensive to expand. If your kid's doing drugs today, he's doing communist drugs. Okay? And the communists have poisoned his mind, and they poisoned his body. and that's to take him out of action. There's no difference between taking a kid down with drugs and a sniper putting a bullet in his head. The results are the same, out of action. Even wounding him. The first leg of the expansion started in January 1967. This was when a new Soviet study on the impact of the technical elite in the industrialized countries was completed. One copy given to the Czechs along with instructions to apply the findings to the drug operation. The study pointed out that with the growing importance of the technical elite, the middle-level technical managers upon whom the growth of high-tech industries so critically depended. And don't think there aren't people trading your 401k in high places that are getting cocaine delivered to the office. You know that commercial where the school bus driver is a druggie? You see her doing drugs, and the next time you see her, she's opening up a school bus to let kids on. These managers had become, don't be afraid to test fifth graders and sixth graders for drugs. It's better to catch them in the fifth and sixth grade than to catch them when they're 22 and mortgaging your house and forging your name. One of the most important groups in bourgeois society. In the Soviet view, they were on par with finance and big business. Accordingly, the group had become a most important target to infiltrate and sabotage. The Soviet studies pointed out that this new elite worked under great pressure, and that as the pressure grew, new opportunities to use drugs and narcotics would arise. Drugs were regarded as especially important as a means of destroying or sabotaging the group, and at the same time as a blackmail or bribery mechanism to use against such people in connection with the Soviet bloc's drive to obtain, steal advanced technology. And you know where how that worked out. There's an F-22 on a Chinese runway tonight. Compliments of the USA and our intelligence weakness. Never forget, the reason we won World War II and defeated the Germans and defeated the Japanese is that we had successfully broken their codes. It looks like the Chinese have broken the Pentagon's code. But you're not going to hear that because they're going to show you, sliding across the seat of a car with no panties on. The use of drugs and narcotics in connection with technology, espionage, and theft had been a long-standing practice dating back to Tsarina's appointment. This is the Czech general who came over to our side. The use of drugs, and I don't say he did it out of the goodness of his heart. He probably came over for the money. But he told everything when he came here because he had nothing to lose but his life if they caught him. The use of drugs in such operations was first significantly increased following a meeting in Moscow convened by Khrushchev in the fall of 59, the top leadership from East European satellites, with the exception of Romania, were present. I guess they didn't trust the Romanians. The subject of the meeting was PAC technology. The key question was how to use the developing East-West relationship to improve the Warsaw PAC's technology as quickly as possible. Savage was very upset one night because he was on an aircraft carrier, and they were visiting Chinese officers and getting a tour of the aircraft carrier. And that was at a time when they wouldn't let the Kitty Hawk into Hong Kong. Tsarina was present at the meeting. The first subject addressed was technology theft. Remember this technology theft. Khrushchev stated that the cheapest and fastest way to improve Warsaw Pact technology was to take it, steal it, like that F-22 on the runway that looks so much like our F-22. As much technology from the imperialists as possible. Its value was doubled if you just take it, he said, and added, why pay the capitalist a profit if we can just take it and use it? As part of this discussion, the use of drugs and narcotics as a mechanism for money and blackmail and technology theft were reviewed. You remember the kid about 2 months ago that jumped off the George Washington Bridge because he was gay, and and his so-called friends videotaped him having homosexual sex with another man, another boy, and he couldn't face his parents, and he couldn't face his peers, so he did a nosedive off the George Washington Bridge. If he was working in military intelligence, somebody could approach him and say, these photos will never go on YouTube. You're safe with us. All you have to do is this. And that's when weakness becomes, one man's weakness becomes another man's banquet. Organized crime was also used to facilitate technology theft. You're not going to convince a criminal that he should give up money, making money, because he's an American. He's not going to do it. There are football coaches in Catholic high schools who loan shark and sell cocaine until they're caught. And when they're caught, the pat answer is, if they're dumb enough to buy it, I'm smart enough to sell it. In 1963 or 1964, the Czechoslovak ministers of defense and interior presented a report to the council on the use of organized crime in technology transfer. The mob will buy and sell anything. Their goal is not to have to pay for it, only to make money on it. The focus was on attempts to steal laser and computer technology. We all know the story of Lucky Luciano was given a favorable treatment by the U.S. government because of his work on the docks from stopping German sabotage and making German agents disappear. The report was politics and war make strange bedfellows. Look, we teamed up with the communists to wipe out the Nazis. Chances are, if Stalin had been the aggressor in Hitler's shoes, we would be teaming up with the Nazis to take out Stalin. The report was 40 pages long and included charts that listed target companies in different countries. I don't think so, because we could never tolerate. America's creed in our hearts is the strong must protect the weak. That's our creed. That's why we have Minutemen. That's why we have Patriots. And we only have a few genetic mistakes, like Bill Maher. Bill Maher, who should be zapped with a laser and have his personality changed. Yeah, turn him into a practicing Catholic. Different organized crime groups and the potential for action in various regions. I never seen a guy as adamant as Bill Maher. This guy has got hate written all over his face. Imagine if he was in charge of something like a concentration camp. The defense counsel's task was to decide in each case whether a civilian or military intelligence should take the lead. By this time, all Soviet bloc intelligence services were active in organized crime in different regions in the world. The Czechs and East Germans were particularly effective in Switzerland, Mexico, and India. The East Germans in South Africa, the Czechoslovaks in Austria and Egypt, the Bulgarians in the Middle East, Greece, Turkey, Italy, and Cyprus, the Hungarians in Spain, Portugal, Belgium, and the United States. Oh, God. We took those poor Hungarians in after they were brutalized by the Russians in the 50s, and I guess the Russians included their own communists in with the refugees. Oh, man, are we in trouble? The gates of Rome. The Soviet Union in Great Britain and France, the Soviets, Czechoslovakia, and East Germans in West Germany. Czechoslovakia had roughly 3 organized crime groups in Switzerland, 7 in Austria, 2 in Mexico, 11 or 12 in India, and 1 each in Argentina and Sweden. In the case of Austria, the head of one of the Czech groups was the chief of police in one of the sections of Vienna. Altogether, money corrupts. Money opens all doors. It's a question of how much. altogether, Czechoslovakia ran or had infiltrated. But one thing that surprised me, nobody's taking the $50 million on Obama's head. I mean, Osama's head. Nobody is going for the $50 million on Osama bin Laden's head. Why? Why? Altogether, Czechoslovakia ran and had infiltrated 50 organized crime groups around the world. Sugina believed this achievement was comparable to those of Bulgaria, Hungary, and Poland. More than that of East Germany, but less than the achievement of the Soviet Union. The Italian mafia had been penetrated by all the Soviet bloc's intelligence services, although the Bulgarians and Soviets were by far the most successful. You know, when I was in the military, we were trained in escape and evasion, that if you are behind enemy lines, try and hook up with a prostitute. Think about that. The existence of a Soviet strategy to infiltrate organized crime, which was launched in 1955, is especially sobering when the extent to which U.S. presidents, intelligence officials, and other high-ranking political leaders are known to have requested favors from members of organized crime is recalled. Consider, for example, the CIA's attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro in the 1960s. In one exercise, individuals from no less than four organized criminal groups centered in Las Vegas, Chicago, Miami, and Havana were involved. One of the principals had been freed from jail by Castro himself and then allowed to leave Cuba and settle in Miami. A Bureau of Narcotics report described this individual as a possible connection for Cuba's narcotics trafficking into the United States in 1955. Even if we disregard the covert Soviet bloc intelligence penetration of organized crime groups, now you wonder, right? Maybe the CIA put a hit on Castro, and the hitter got more money from Castro to hit JFK. Huh? There's another, what they call those theories. It does not require much imagination to recognize why, as historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. described the situation, Castro survived so comfortably the ministrations of the CIA. The tendency to turn to organized crime for special tasks is not an activity that is unique to the U.S. strategic leadership. It is a rather common activity in many countries. It seems unlikely that any of the public officials concerned has been or is aware of the hidden risks in pursuing such activities, which could arise because of the covert presence of the Soviet bloc intelligence agents. The huge potential value. I wonder how many Soviet agents are here today. What are they called? The Russian Mafia? And of the Soviets' genius in developing effective strategic operations. An intelligence study reviewed by Sugina described the manner in which organized crime was categorized in Soviet planning. There were three principal categories, the code names of which were blue, purple, and yellow butterfly. In the first category were relatively small groups involved in local crimes. For example, small narcotics distribution, banks, and finance. In the second category were criminal groups related to drugs and to technology transfers. The third category contained the more traditional criminal operations, such as the mob, which were penetrated for intelligence information of a military, political, or economic nature. Each principal category was further broken down into three subgroups referred to as Alpha, Beta, and Gamma. The first group consisted of organized crime networks which had been created and were fully controlled by Warsaw Pact Intelligence Service. Organizations in the second group were created by someone else but had been penetrated by Warsaw Pact intelligence agents and could be exploited. In the third group were known organizations that the Warsaw Pact intelligence services had been unable to penetrate. At a Czech Defense Council meeting, Khrushchev's deputy, Andrei Kirilenko, spoke to top Czech officials about Khrushchev's concern over the program. He explained that Khrushchev had asked why the categories we cannot control completely were the largest. Why do we not switch the statistics? He asked. Kirilenko then inquired whether the Warsaw Pact Intelligence Service was scared of professional criminals. When you deal with the criminals, he stated firmly, you must be tougher than they are. Isn't that the truth with anybody you deal with? The measure taken in 1967 to target the newly identified technical elite for sabotage, espionage, and technology theft was the second important intensification of across-the-board technology theft operations using drugs and narcotics, in which Tsigina was a direct witness and participant. Each year, the Defense Council reviewed the technology stolen from the preceding year. If it then met and approved a plan describing what was to be stolen during the subsequent year. In reviewing a stolen technology at the end of 67, Antonin Novotny, first secretary of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, remarked to the Soviet general Leonid Brezhnev that drugs were of great help in stealing technology. General Oldrich Berda, the Z chief, added that 20 to 25% of technology stolen in 1967, the total value of which was estimated at $300 million, had been acquired through the use of drugs. In the spring of 1967, the Czech strategic leadership received additional guidance from the Soviet Union. In April, Tsigina, Jiří Hendrik, and Lieutenant General Vakulov Pritchlik traveled to Moscow, where they met with the Soviet General Alexei Yepishev, Chief of the Main Political Administration, and General Shevchenko, Chief of the Department of Special Propaganda. At the meeting, Shevchenko discussed the continued importance of infiltrating the banks and financial institutions. Collecting data for military purposes was one objective, and he stressed the importance of using drugs to corrupt people in these institutions. The financial institutions were so important, Shevchenko emphasized, that careful attention was to be exercised by the satellite propaganda apparatus to keep these institutions out of the limelight. The Soviets did not want any light to be thrown on the banks. Okay, we got 16 minutes left. Previously in 1963, during a meeting of the Czech Defense Council, when money laundering was being discussed, the chief of the general staff had stated that the Soviets had decided that officials in the Soviet finance department should not be informed about the precise sources of the funds they were handling, because there was too great a risk of compromise. At risk, the Soviet advisor had explained, were people in 75% of the banks in Latin America and in 45% of the banks in the United States and Canada. When the amount of money involved was considered around $300 billion per year in the USA in the late 1980s, $500 billion or more per year worldwide, these percentages certainly do not seem high. It's a lot of money to me. Furthermore, in the spring of 67, General Savankin, head of the Soviet Administrative Organs Department, convened a meeting in Moscow. Savankin chaired the meetings, and Cuba was included. Numerous Soviet intelligence generals were present, and then he names them: Raul Castro, Cuba's Minister of Interior, the Deputy Military Intelligence Chief in charge of narcotics, and one other. The only countries represented were East Germany, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Poland. One of the most important topics addressed at this particular meeting was the importance of attacking NATO and U.S. military forces more aggressively with drugs. Detailed studies of all NATO forces were presented and their vulnerabilities discussed. In the remarks, Savinkin identified three primary objectives: one, to corrupt officers; two, to recruit agents; and to impair the functioning of troops. The offensive against the U.S. troops based overseas received special emphasis. Savinkin explained that areas where U.S. troops were based, in Germany, Turkey, Greece, Panama, and so forth, were, to use a military term, to become zones of strategic destruction. This task was so important that Major General Vasil Fedorenko was placed in charge of coordinating the attack. Each country had a similar coordinator designated, who acted as a primary liaison with Fedorenko. And as will be discussed shortly, the need to corrupt U.S. forces in NATO received additional emphasis in the fall of 1967. By 1970, the standard of U.S. commander forces in NATO had in fact already fallen to dangerously low levels and was soon to trigger far-reaching disciplinary measures. In this operation, Panama received special emphasis because of the Panama Canal, which Jimmy Carter gave away. Jimmy, the commie Carter. So Obama's not the first communist. And because of the presence in Panama of several U.S. military... Beware of people who think internationally. Primarily. And country second. Colonel František Penn of Czechoslovak intelligence was in charge of the operation in Panama. He was a liaison to Fedorenko for drug trafficking against U.S. bases in other regions of the world. A list of officers had been drawn up with the assistance of the Communist Party of Panama. They had all operated with the Communist Party and some had contributed money to the party. The officers were not targets to be destroyed, General Shevchenko emphasized, but to be protected because some of them were our gold reserve. Many, if not most of them, were involved with drugs. One of the Panamanian officers on the list was Omar Torrijos Herrera, who was to seize control of Panama in 1969. Raul Castro said that Cuba believed that anti-American sentiments were even stronger among lower-level officers and that the Cubans would like to focus more attention on recruiting lower-level officers. The Soviets concurred with this proposal. By 1972, Panama had developed such a severe drug problem that special measures were discussed at the U.S. Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, subsequently absorbed, and they were known as the BNDD, now they're in the DEA. In an attack on Noriega in 1986, the New York Times published a detailed account of these anxieties. John Ingersoll, who was then head of the Bureau of National Dangerous Drugs, confirmed he had hard intelligence Noriega was trafficking in drugs, adding that BNDD had been frustrated in its attempts to persuade General Torrijos to take action against Noriega. According to a 1978 Senate Intelligence Committee report, five measures had been discussed to deal with Guardia Nacional Official, which was the committee's description of Noriega. Link Noriega to a fictitious plot against Torrijos. Leak information on Noriega's drug trafficking to the press. Link negotiations over the Panama Canal to Noriega's removal, secretly encourage powerful groups in Panama to raise the issue, and total and complete immobilization, which was, of course, a euphemism for assassination. Colombia was another country which the Moscow meeting held in the spring of 67 discussed in detail. With respect to Colombia, Raul Castro recommended that Cuba should develop more than one group to control drug trafficking. And that's why Fidel is worth a bundle today. Some people say he's worth $670 million. At the time, there were two Soviet-controlled operations, while his people eat as still life paintings. At the time, there were two Soviet-controlled operations, the Cuban operation and the Czech operation. Savinkin pointed out the number of groups should be kept to a minimum. The more groups there were, the more people would be in the know, and the greater was the risk of exposure. He was referring to exposure of the Soviet operation. Castro agreed, but said the risk was also high with just one group because of the internal politics involved. Savinkin approved Castro's recommendations and emphasized that it was Cubans' responsibility and he would trust their judgment in this matter, but that Havana should be careful not to go too far. Raul also raised the question of how much the Communist Party of Colombia should be told and presented a long list of people corrupted by the drug trade in Colombia, which had been assembled by Cuban intelligence agents who had infiltrated the indigenous Colombian drug trafficking networks. The Soviets were concerned about some of the names on the list, whom they believed to be among various double agents, whom the indigenous drug trafficking organizations had corrupted and were using against the Soviet-Cuban drug operation. Savinkin said that these people were all criminals and cannot trust any of them either. In a review of Mexico, Savinkin said there were no corrections to be made in respect to the corruption of Mexican political officials. For all practical purposes, they had all been corrupted. The next priority was to work on the Mexican business elite. There were also discussions about the networks in Western Europe. The principal outlets in the European market was Switzerland, Austria, Vienna, and Stockholm, Sweden. All of the Soviet bloc intelligence services operated in these regions, which served as centers for drug distribution and for the covert transfer of stolen technology to the Soviet bloc. Panama was also to become a center for these two activities. Intelligence linkages to other countries favored certain national intelligence services. For example, the Germans were particularly active in marketing drugs through the Netherlands, and you can see the Netherlands is one stone junkie today. Yeah. They're all tiptoeing through the tulips, stoned. Another topic discussed, and then you got these communists here in this country, and their liberal counterparts are saying, oh, yeah, Amsterdam's a good example of legalized drugs. Yes, everybody in Europe is doing it. We should be, too. We should catch up to Europe. Yeah. They had destroyed themselves. Bulgarian officials said that Turkey and Iran had posed no problem. They had destroyed themselves. Savinkin criticized this remark and told the Bulgarians to listen more carefully. He was referring to the elite class. They must improve the quality of drugs and push their use into the upper classes. In 1967, the head of the Health Administration briefed the Czechoslovak Defense Council on seven or eight new drugs, which had been developed in the course of their drug research and development program. Here, we're trying to find pills that help people live longer and cure their ailments. And here, these guys are looking to find pills that kill everybody, starting with the mind, which had been developed in the course of their drug research. The research activity had been started 5 years earlier in a central military hospital in Prague, specifically for the development of chemical and biological warfare agents, mind control drugs, assassination weapons, and even more effective narcotics. The drugs reviewed in 67 were a product of this program. They had been developed by scientists and medical doctors from the Central Military Hospital and tested on prisoners. The new drugs were considered more effective because their immediate effects were longer lasting. And I told you, I had a friend of mine who was who came here from Russia, and he had been a war protester in the Soviet Union, and he refused to be drafted, and they put him in an insane asylum. And I said, who was there with you? He said, professors. Professors and intellectuals. And what happened to them? He says, they all died. I said, how come you didn't die? He says, I did everything they told me. The new drugs were considered more effective because their immediate effects were longer lasting. He also said they used to inject them with stuff that used to cook their brain. As a bonus, they caused long-term damage in the capacity of humans to think logically. You mean like the guy the Democrats sent to Arizona to pull a communist stunt? You see, I can get crazy too. Sagina was particularly impressed with one of the more effective drugs that left the user optimistic but put him in a no-worries, don't-care frame of mind. When tested on prisoners, the prisoners became unconcerned about penalties or having to spend their whole lives in jail. The longer-term effects tested after 2 to 3 years were residual mental attitudes of passivity and resignation. The test subjects didn't even try to make intelligent decisions. Evidently, the drug attacked the center of motivation. Amazing, isn't it? At the briefing, the Czechoslovak doctors recommended three drugs that they believed would be the drugs of the future. The Soviet advisor who attended the meeting said the drugs should not be marketed then because they might cause questions to be asked. At that time, the Soviets believed that the blame for the drug epidemic, as desired, had been successfully placed on organized crime. Hey, you mafia guys out here, you're getting a bad rap. Yeah, if we put new drugs on the market, the Soviets reason, people in the West might become suspicious. We need to be very careful to wait until the correct time. For example, when there are other potential co-producers who can be blamed as a source of new drugs. Another especially interesting new dimension arose in September 1967 in connection with a visit by Raul Castro to Czechoslovakia. Castro was accompanying him was several high-level Cuban officials, chief of military intelligence, medical administration, administrative organs department, blah, blah, blah. The principal subject of the meeting was the drug and narcotics operation, the sizable expansion of Cuban and Soviet bloc and narcotics trafficking activity was agreed. At this meeting, too, a protocol was signed which enabled Cuban scientists, 17 or 18 of them, to assist a joint Soviet bloc researching teams working on drugs and narcotics. Henceforth, the Cuban scientists would be working with Czech scientists, but not with other Soviet bloc teams. And this was an indirect way of bringing the Cubans into the Soviet bloc program. Castro was particularly forceful in presenting his position to the Soviets. He argued that it was important to push the aspect of drug trafficking operations even harder and advance the onset of stagnation by targeting younger students, particularly high school students and children. I told you, in a high school in New Jersey of good repute, there are 176 students in rehab. The Soviets were thinking in terms of 40 to 50 years to get the desired results. These are long-term planners, my friend. Looks like I got 1 minute left, and so I'm going to finish up. And let me see if I can find a quick tune to exit out with. We'll say goodbye with the Eye of the Tiger. That 17 seconds remaining, now 8. We will meet again, hopefully tomorrow night. Until then, sayonara.